we don't feel as a customer that we received the product that we should have received for that expenditure.
The city of Anchorage sues the federal government over the bungled port project. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, March 3rd. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the Iditarod is growing in popularity with Norwegians.
We were here in 2011 and we actually were at the ceremony of that. We were like, this is kind of cool. Maybe we should run this one day. So we went home and we bred dogs and we came.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. The University of Alaska Southeast offers degree programs you won't find anywhere else, like the customizable BLA, online or on campus, information at uas.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Southeast.
The municipality of Anchorage is suing a federal agency over problems with a port expansion project. This is the second lawsuit the administration of Mayor Dan Sullivan has initiated to try to recover funds spent on the troubled port project. KSKA's Daisha Eaton has more.
The city has invested around $300 million so far and hopes to get some of that money back. They're suing the U.S. Department of Transportation Maritime Administration, or MARAD, which managed the original port expansion project, for damages. Anchorage Mayor Dan Sullivan made the announcement at City Hall Monday.
To date, we've raised, through both federal, local, and state sources, over $400 million for the project. And MARAD was responsible for the administration of the spending of that money. And quite frankly, we don't feel as a customer that we received the product that we should have received for that expenditure.
Problems arose in 2009 when the open cell sheet pile design crumpled and separated during construction. The Sullivan administration has led the push to get the municipality reimbursed. The municipality is also suing engineering firm CH2M Hill, which purchased the now defunct Vico Corporation. Vico was involved in the original work that had problems. Last week, the Anchorage Assembly awarded CH2M Hill a $30 million contract to manage the new port project. CH2M Hill assured municipal officials that nobody who worked on the first project would be involved in the new one. Sullivan says the port project is poised to move ahead.
We will start working on updating permits, certainly working on a new final design for the port. So we're going to continue moving forward with the project while this action happens in court. And so we want to make sure we don't lose momentum on making sure that over the next a number of months that we develop a really solid plan. We've got a good team on board, and we're remaining committed that we've got this project back on track.
Design and engineering work is anticipated to take 18 months to 2 years, with construction likely starting in 2016. The Port of Anchorage provides an estimated 90% of the merchandise goods for 85% of Alaska's populated area, and it's the major point of entry for container cargo and fuel for Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson and Ted Stevens International Airport. In Anchorage, I'm Daisha Eaton.
Four-time Iditarod champion Martin Boozer is currently in the lead in this year's running of the Iditarod Trail Sled Dog Race. He blew through the Roan checkpoint and is en route to Nikolai. Kelly Maxner, Michael Williams Jr., Nicholas Pettit, Paul Gebhardt, and Hugh Neff have all made it into Roan. Other teams are still making their way into Rainy Pass as they head through the Alaska Range. It's arguably the toughest stretch of trail. Many mushers tell KUAC's Emily Schwing they're ready for the challenge, including a contingent of Norwegians who are in Alaska to find out how their dog teams fare on this side of the world.
The Iditarod has been called the Super Bowl of mushing. That's how Yvonne DeBock describes her run to Nome.
It's Mush's paradise. You got to check it out. We were here in 2011 and we actually were at the ceremonial site. We were like, this is kind of cool. Maybe we should run this one day. So we went home and we bred dogs and we came.
DeBock was surprised to find out she's not the only Norwegian driving a team in this year's Iditarod.
You know, they're all just following after us. We had planned this for a while. And then suddenly you hear, Robert's going to come back. We're like, oh, that's cool. And then Rolf was like, I'm going to go over. And then we heard that our friend Tommy is going to stay here for 10 months. And they're all going to run it. And I was like, oh, that 1 year we're going to go over. And you're all going to come? That's cool.
Of the five Norwegian teams, at least two may prove very competitive, including last year's Rookie of the Year, Jor Leifseth Olsen.
It's a good team, and they've all done a 1,000-mile race before. Now and lots of other races, so they have a lot of experience and they know what to do and they know how to rest and don't get too excited about things. So I think if things fall together, we can have a good run.
Olsen is not much for words. He's tall, shy, and quiet, which might be to his advantage as he tries to navigate his way past two-time champion Robert Sorley.
To win the Adidas is not easy, so it'd be very, very difficult. You had to have no accidents. Everything's had to go fine all the way.
Sorley says he never starts a race he doesn't intend to win. But it's different for Tommy Jordbrodal. He brought seven dogs from Norway simply so they could get to know the trail.
You just can't do enough traveling with your dogs, you know, and because it's such a good atmosphere and all the distance that you're going to do. And it's just all aspects of it. It's just totally fascinating. Yeah.
Much like his Norwegian compatriots, Jordbrodal plans to return to the race again for a more competitive effort after he gets a rookie run under his belt. On the Iditarod Trail, I'm Emily Schwing in Willow.
Alaska's U.S. Senate race is shaping up to be a big money affair. One hidden asset the campaigns deploy is the professional fundraiser. For congressional races, these are typically Washington-based consultants who help connect the candidates to wealthy political contributors nationwide. They tend to be a discreet lot, but APRN's Liz Ruskin found one who tells us how it works.
Senator Mark Begich and the Republican frontrunners hoping to unseat him all list professional fundraisers in their campaign finance reports, but they declined to talk about it. That's not unusual, says fundraiser Kirsten Borman. She says there's too much at stake for a campaign to pull back the curtain.
It's the way it is that money, your money in the bank, your cash on hand, your quarterly reports really are a large indicator that the world looks at as to how your campaign is doing.
If she had Alaska clients, she wouldn't be talking to us either. Borman mostly works for Florida congressional campaigns. She writes a blog on fundraising and serves as something of a spokeswoman for the profession. Money is blamed for a lot of evil in politics, but she's proud of what she does.
I facilitate people being able to invest in the candidates and the type of government that they want, and that, to me, is free speech at its best and at its finest.
She says fundraisers usually work on commission, 10 to 15%, and stick to clients of one party. Borman, who works only for Republicans, says each new job helps her develop her donor database, one of the biggest assets any fundraiser brings to a campaign.
And obviously, the more clients you have, the better you get to know donors. I mean, fundraising is all about relationships, and it's about building and maintaining relationships with people who want to invest in good public servants.
Good fundraisers collect data on what prompts each donor to give, an email, a phone call, maybe a small reception with the candidate, and what issues they care about. Incumbents start with rich data, but even first-time candidates have networks to mine. Take Dan Sullivan, one of the Republicans running against Begich. More than a third of the $1.2 million Sullivan raised last year came from Ohio, much of it from people associated with his brother Frank, CEO of the company that makes Rust-Oleum. But Sullivan also hired MK Group, a fundraiser for the Bush family and National Right to Life. His GOP rival Mead Treadwell hired Lisa Spees, a former Mitt Romney fundraiser. University of Connecticut political science professor Paul Hernson says candidates are really operating two campaigns, one for votes back home and one for money.
Fundraising, unlike collecting votes, is a fully national activity.
The campaign for votes has a limited season, he says, but for incumbents, the campaign for money is perpetual. And it's intensified since Citizens United. The Supreme Court decision let money flood into political attack groups. Hernson says it created a massive wild card.
Candidates didn't know what was coming at them, and so the threat level became higher, and candidates who could raise lots of money, and that is mainly incumbents, raised more because they were not sure of what they would face in the election.
Senator Mark Begich relies on a Washington outfit called Benchmark Strategies for fundraising. His campaign paid Benchmark more than $100,000 in the last 3 months of the year, far more than his Republican challengers paid their fundraisers in the same period. Begich also leads the way in the money race. But Stephen Medvec, government professor at Franklin and Marshall College, says there's little evidence fundraising consultants actually reap more than a campaign would raise on its own.
Lots of organizations and lots of big donors, they keep their eye out for candidates who they think might have a chance. And if a candidate shows any sign of being competitive, they'll cut a check and send it, sometimes, you know, completely unsolicited.
But he says big fundraisers lend cachet to a campaign. They make a candidate seem more viable. That alone draws money, particularly from national donors. And he doesn't see that as a bad thing. Like it or not, it takes a lot of money to win. And Medvec says fundraising consultants make the task easier.
I guess the question is, you know, do you want the candidate spending most of his or her time out raising money, or do you want them out talking to voters?
And then he laughs. Let's not kid ourselves, he says. Even with professional help, candidates still have to spend a lot of their time asking for money. In Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, enhancing exhibit and research space for polar bears at the Anchorage Zoo.
If there should be a premier exhibit on this species, it should be in Alaska.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. The University of Alaska Anchorage, where teams of students and professors are generating innovative solutions for relevant issues like a mouth guard that can measure the impact of concussions and lead to better forms of protection. The University of Alaska Anchorage, amazing stories being written every day. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Anchorage.
Senator Mark Begich used his annual address to the legislature to chastise state lawmakers for their approach to education. He highlighted staffing cuts in Anchorage and Juneau as evidence that the legislature was not allocating enough money to schools.
I'll be blunt. I don't agree with what's happened in this building on education funding in recent years. It's like you're built a fire in a wood stove, but refuse to add enough wood. Now some are complaining the stove doesn't work and we need a new, brand new heating system.
Begich later told reporters that he thought Governor Sean Parnell's funding proposal did not go far enough. Parnell has suggested raising the base student allocation, or the amount of money a school gets for each child enrolled, by $85 this year. Smaller increases would be built in for 2 years after that. Begich also came out against a measure that would allow state funds to be used for private schools.
I believe strongly we should never amend the Alaska Constitution as a fix to education. Public dollars are for public education, period.
The line got applause from Democrats and moderate Republicans in the legislature. The measure was introduced last year by Senator Mike Dunleavy, a Mat-Su Republican. It needs approval from two-thirds of the legislature before it can be put on the ballot for a majority vote of the people. Dunleavy says he was perplexed by Begich's attention to internal state issues instead of focusing on federal policy. Following his address, Begich noted that while his son currently attends private school, he thinks it would be inappropriate for government to cover his tuition. Keegan Randall is back on top. Following disappointing races at the Sochi Olympics, Randall of Anchorage won a World Cup sprint race in Finland over the weekend. Teammate Sophie Caldwell placed third. The U.S. ski team says it's the first ever double podium finish for the women's team and the first time in modern era that a woman, other than Randall, finished on the podium in an individual race. Saturday's victory put Randall back on top of the women's World Cup sprint standings as she tries to hold on to the title she's held for the last 2 years. This weekend's World Cup races in Finland were also the European Tour debut for U.S. skier Reese Honeman of Fairbanks. Honeman, who earned World Cup starts by skiing to top finishes at January's U.S. National Championships, placed 73rd in yesterday's 15-kilometer race. The state of Alaska will sue over contamination from the Flint Hills North Pole refinery. Historic sulfolane spills have resulted in the industrial solvent migrating through groundwater. State Attorney General Mike Garrity says the state wants to sort out responsible parties, which include former facility owner Williams.
There are other parties besides Flint Hills, which has been bearing most of the cost up to this point, but most of the sulfolane contamination occurred while Williams, its predecessor, owned the facility. And so the state's going to be taking action here in the coming weeks to try to bring these parties to the table and see what we can work out.
Garrity adds that the state of Alaska has more than a regulatory stake in the contamination and potentially shares responsibility with Flint Hills and Williams.
The Department of Natural Resources owned the property and leased it to Williams.
Flint Hills and Williams are already involved in a court battle over the sulfolane contamination, which affects hundreds of private property owners. Flint Hills cited contamination liability when it announced in early February a decision to cease refining operations this summer. Last week, Governor Sean Parnell indicated the state would help facilitate sale of the refinery to keep it operating. Garrity confirms any new entity would not be held liable for contamination.
We can work out what's called a prospective purchase agreement with a new buyer, new refinery operator, as the case may be. Now, if they just bought the refinery next week, presumably they wouldn't have any responsibility for this contamination.
The refinery shutdown would have rippling economic impacts from local job losses to reduced business for the Alaska Railroad, which is a major shipper of Flint Hills products.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future, delivering oil today, sustaining operations for tomorrow. The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2014 PFD. Paper applications are located in your community. More information at pfd.alaska.gov or on Facebook. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska. If you're interested in serving on your local Federal Subsistence Regional Advisory Council, the deadline to apply is Friday, March 21st. Call 1-800-478-1456 for more information. This message sponsored by U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
Friday's announcement by the EPA to seek a 404C designation under the Clean Water Act for the proposed Pebble Mine has drawn praise and outrage. KDLG's Mike Mason has more.
The EPA is formally starting the process of reviewing whether or not to use its authority under the Clean Water Act to stop the issuance of permits that would be needed for the Pebble Mine to proceed to development. The agency sent a formal letter Friday to the Pebble Limited Partnership, the State of Alaska, and the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. The letter basically informs them that the EPA will proceed with a formal review of the 404C designation. The EPA is quick to point out that the review is limited solely to the proposed Pebble Mine, and the agency will not consider other mining or non-mining related developments in the Bristol Bay watershed. The decision prompted State Senator Kathy Geisel to take to the floor of the Alaska Senate on Friday. The Republican says the EPA's actions will preempt a significant resource development project in southwest Alaska. Geisel stressed the proposed Pebble Mine would sit on land owned by the state of Alaska that has always been open to mineral exploration and possible development. She also called into question the justification cited by the EPA.
They are basing this on what they call scientific evidence. Mr. President, it can't possibly be scientific evidence in light of the fact that this project has not even submitted a permit application yet. And so there is no project. It cannot be scientifically evaluated because it simply doesn't exist at this point.
During Friday's floor speech, Senator Geisel labeled the EPA's decision as outrageous and unprecedented.
I foresee that this action, this type of action, if executed efficiently or effectively here in Alaska, will reach into the Lower 48 projects as well. This is federal overreach on steroids.
In the letter sent to the state, the Pebble developers, and the Corps of Engineers, the EPA stated that there is reason to believe that porphyry copper mining of the scale contemplated at the Pebble deposit would result in significant and unacceptable adverse effects to important fishery areas in the Bristol Bay watershed. In recent years, the Bristol Bay Native Corporation has called for permanent protections for the region. The corporation's CEO is Jason Matrokin.
Bristol Bay Native Corporation continues to appreciate the fact that the EPA is working to identify options to protect the Bristol Bay region from the risks that the Pebble Mine project poses. We've said all along that BB&C supports responsible development in the region, but the science has shown that the proposed Pebble Mine project presents significant risks to the Bristol Bay fishery, to the people, and to the local economy.
The EPA's decision to pursue a 404C designation for the proposed Pebble Mine also drew praise from the new bishop for the Orthodox Church in Alaska. Bishop David Mahaffey released a statement characterizing Friday's announcement as the next step in the process to ensure protection for the communities that depend on Bristol Bay. District 36 State Representative Bryce Edgman from Dillingham released a statement in support of the EPA's action, which he labeled as a historic milestone in the decade-long effort to protect Bristol Bay from massive-scale sulfide mining. The 404C process outlined by the EPA on Friday includes the opportunity for public comment from all stakeholders, including the Pebble Limited Partnership, the State of Alaska, and Native communities in the Bristol Bay region. In Dillingham, I'm Mike Mason.
Alaska Governor Sean Parnell calls the EPA's decision a preemptive veto.
What I think that does is short-circuit a public process called a state permitting process. The EPA has, under NEPA and under the Clean Water Act, has the ability to be an influence and a responsibility to be an influence in the state permitting process. But exercising a preemptive veto like they have proposed doing is something that I think should not be done. I think that if they set that precedent and continue down that road, that's going to be a dangerous precedent for a lot of our country.
Governor Parnell made his comments today in Petersburg. The Alaska Zoo in Anchorage has been home to a long line of polar bears over the years, from the infamous sneaker-stealing Binky to the fluffy cub Cully, which was shipped to a sister zoo back east last year. Right now, Apoon, a female, and Luiktik, a young male, are the only two residents in the zoo's polar bear enclosure, but that is soon to change. As KSKA's Ellen Lockyer reports, the zoo plans a new program that is expected to help Alaska lead the country in polar bear captive breeding and research.
Polar bears in the United States were listed as threatened in May of 2008. In past years, the Alaska Zoo has provided a temporary home for 9 orphaned polar bear cubs in cooperation with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. It isn't easy to raise a polar bear. Alaska Zoo Director Pat Lampe ought to know.
We've had 2 within the last less than 4 years. So we feel it's important to be ready.
Lampe says the zoo needs more room for cubs.
You can't introduce a young cub in with an adult for 2 to 3 years. And so we really don't have the facility currently to be able to keep any more adults.
Right now, the zoo's permanent polar bear exhibit has room enough for 2 adult residents. Apoon came to the zoo as an orphan from the North Slope. Luiktik was born in captivity in Russia, then sent to an Australian zoo before ending up in Alaska. It is hoped that the 2 bears will become more than roommates, and plans are to expand the polar bear enclosure to provide denning space for Apoon should she become pregnant.
If our female got pregnant, you need to have some separation from her and the male. If we have to separate our bears for some reason, currently they're either one can be inside and one can be outside. So this would give us the opportunity that if we had to separate Apoon and Louie, that we could move one of them over to this new area. They would have a separate denning area and some outdoor area and some small pools to access.
The Alaska Zoo's ambitious expansion plan will be completed in 2 phases. Phase 1 will be a transition facility for orphan bear cubs, and Phase 2 will triple the size of the current permanent polar bear exhibit and include maternity dens. Last year, the Fish and Wildlife Service gave the zoo a 5-year authorization to be a rescue facility for North Slope polar bears. The Alaska Zoo is the only facility in the United States to have such an agreement with the federal agency.
Alaska is the only state that has polar bears native to its lands. If there should be a premier exhibit on this species, it should be in Alaska.
Eileen Floyd is the zoo's major gifts director. Floyd says the expansion plan has been under consideration for 5 years. The cost of the combined phases is about $8 million, but the zoo has most of the $1.4 million needed to begin work on the orphan cub transition facility. Fundraising has begun on the $6 million needed for phase two. Lampe and Floyd say many zoos are not taking polar bear cubs now because of recent rules set by the government of Manitoba.
Those standards are being adopted by zoos in the United States. That's the new bar for everybody to reach.
So if you're building a polar bear exhibit, you're going to build to those standards.
The zoo's expansion will be up to the Manitoba standards, with natural substrate in the outdoor yard area where bears can dig to their heart's content. Polar bears can live up to 40 years in captivity and can breed well into their 20s. Breeding polar bears in captivity could help researchers understand the reasons for reproductive failures in declining wild populations.
It's for the benefit of the wild population and the captive population.
The cub, Cully, will someday provide wild population DNA for future breeding programs. Lampe says a polar bear raised in captivity would most likely spend its life in captivity. He says the future of the polar bear can't be predicted during this time of change, but science can help.
Keep an eye on the science and what's going on with the pack sea ice up there. They're an amazing species, and it would be devastating to let them die off.
The Alaska Zoo collaborates with the Cincinnati and Memphis zoos on reproductive studies on polar bears. Other studies could show how much energy it costs a polar bear to swim, and one would even set protocols on how to wash polar bears in the event of an Arctic oil spill. Specially designed washing tables are already in place at Prudhoe Bay and at the Alaska Zoo. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Daisha Eaton and Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Emily Schwing on the Iditarod Trail, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Mike Mason in Dillingham. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau and Liz Ruskin from Washington, D.C. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. Get away and stay in AK at UAS Juno, small enough that your professors know you by name, big enough for a vibrant campus community with a new residence hall opening fall of 2014. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Southeast.
There's a good feeling you get when you give, and each year more Alaskans are supporting things they love when they file online for their PFD. Alaskans like you donated $2.5 million last year to strengthen education, help families in need of food and shelter, and protect the most vulnerable among us. You even shared your permanent fund dividends with public radio to keep quality programming alive and well. This year, the PFD is expected to be a lot bigger. So come on, love Alaska. Pick, click, give. This message sponsored by Rasmussen Foundation.
Support for APRN Iditarod coverage comes from Wells Fargo, proud supporter of the Iditarod Trail Sled Dog Race and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the trail. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.